Hey, welcome back, everybody, to my podcast. After a short, minimal break, this episode is with Tim Fanning, and we record this podcast on the road in Cartagena, Colombia. It's a special episode because it was a spur-of-the-moment type of situation. We talked about it. We decided to record an episode, and it's about his path to where he's at right now in BYU basketball as an assistant coach. We talked about his path in Europe from Spain, 7th division in Spain, to being a EuroLeague assistant at Maccabi Tel Aviv, learning from head coaches like Yanis Sveropoulos and other coaches along the way. He talked about his OTE experience. He talked about the young guys, coaching young guys versus coaching veteran players, and an interesting perspective on how rookies come to Europe and how to set the expectation level right. So lots of communication topics, of course. And I would like to for you to subscribe to this podcast. If you're a consistent listener, that's great. If you're not subscribed, I need you to subscribe. If you know people who need to listen to this, please share. Please like this episode, comment, and I hope to see you on the next one too. Thanks for being here. Bye.
All right, Tim. We're in Cartagena, Colombia. With a beautiful view at the Hilton, after trying to make some research, trying to find the best location, scouting locations all across Cartagena, we figured out that it's just across the hallway. It's the best view of Cartagena. So let's start this podcast off with a nice introduction of who Tim Fanning is.
Yeah, that was an interesting experience, man. Looking all across the city, and then what we needed was right across the hall. I would say I am a learner. I think at my core, I really enjoy learning. And throughout, you know, the last years or, you know, my years post school, post college, it's taken me across the world and had some, really unique and impactful experiences on and off the basketball court. But I think at my core, I really enjoy learning, about myself, about other people. Obviously about basketball, spending time in different cultures and learning about those cultures. I think that's really what motivates me. And
I've gotten to know you on this trip a little bit better than I knew before. Obviously, for the people that don't know, we've met before the World Cup, I think, even, right?
In Klaipeda.
In Klaipeda, yeah.
Klaipeda, the coffee shop in Klaipeda.
Yeah, you know the coffee shop better than I do, but back then it was a meeting with, you were with the New Zealand national team. I was with Lithuanian national team. We were exchanging thoughts, ideas. And then we met up during the World Cup again and we exchanged shirts. Even. I remember that.
Yep.
I still have that New Zealand shirt somewhere. How did the learning that you did throughout the travels, which we hear, like you speak Spanish, you speak Portuguese, you're a well-traveled man, you have understanding of personalities. How did the New Zealand experience coaching, because you were a head coach there as well,
yep,
in New Zealand itself, not only with the national team as an assistant coach, but also head coach in New Zealand in the New Zealand League. How did the learning that you did along the way, how did that impact and how did it change your perspective after being a coach, a head coach in New Zealand?
Let's see. I mean, for me, the New Zealand experience, that was the most impactful thing about New Zealand was seeing a player-led, like a player leadership situation in basketball. And that was something I really felt with the national team, with the coach Ninad. He really empowered like the leaders of that team to kind of, you know, take control of the team in some ways, in a lot of aspects. And then also then in New Zealand with the Nelson Giants, we had a player by the name of Phil Jones who played throughout Europe and he was at the end of his career. And he really helped me as a young coach just kind of understand, you know, the impact that can have. And then I saw that firsthand. And I think also just like culturally, Kiwis are extremely proud and they're extremely proud of playing basketball the right way and playing with a team mindset and all that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, especially in New Zealand, that's really something that stood out for me was just like, you know, how impactful a player-led locker room can be.
Yeah, there's leadership is so important, you know, not only because the players also get tired of the coach's voice, you know, like I get tired of my voice today a little bit, but the player's voice inside, it's so important that it compensates a lot of what the coaches shouldn't have to talk about. you know, and I think that New Zealand has a prideful culture, has a very, very, you know better than me probably, but it's just a matter of, for them, of discipline, toughness. What was that book called again with the about the rugby team that was, based in New Zealand?
The rugby it's about the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And like the, I think it's Seven Lessons of Leadership.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's, and they take an ownership. Basically, yeah. taking yeah. ownership, sweeping the locker room, everybody. Yeah. They clean up the whole rugby culture
yeah.
and made it a world-class team
yeah.
just because they took ownership.
Yeah.
So it seems like it goes all across the board of New Zealand basketball,
yeah.
Sports.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, at its core, it's about getting the right people in the locker room. And then once you get the right people in the locker room, they'll do the right thing. So sometimes you got to just step out of the way. Yeah. Now, in the way to getting the players there and making sure you have the right people in the locker room there, maybe you have to have a little bit more discretion, have to have a little bit more of a criteria. But then once you get those people in the locker room that you feel comfortable about, that you've now gotten to know in that recruiting process, if you give them some space, they should join together and kind of push the thing in the right direction.
I think it's on you also to recognize like when you have to step away,
yeah.
you know, when not to talk.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of times the coaches want to talk out and a lot of coaches like to hear themselves talk.
Yeah.
But it's also on them to recognize like, I need to shut up right now.
Yeah.
Because now it's the player's voice.
I remember very specifically talking to Phil before the season and talking about, you know, what core values we want to play with and kind of coming up with a list. And at the end, we just got in the room as a team without giving them anything. And kind of, I asked the players, you know, how do you guys want to be viewed? You know, how do you guys want this team to operate? How do you guys want this team to run? And we came up with a list of, I can't remember, four or five different core values that then, you know, the players felt very strongly about having ownership in. And I think that, every single day, the team and the players, you know, live those things out. And I think that had I come into the room and been like, hey, guys, you know, this is how we're going to play. These are going to be our values. I'm extremely confident that it wouldn't have turned out that way, even if it was the same list.
Yeah.
But just having it come from them was something that I saw that, like, they bought into it. And then it was a point of reference throughout the season. If the practice wasn't going the way that we or they had already decided that this is how we want to move, the conversation was very simple in terms of like, this isn't me telling you what to do. This is you guys saying what you want to do, but we're not doing it. So we got to course correct.
Yeah, you hold them accountable.
Yeah. Much easier.
Yeah. And that's one thing I remember also when I was coaching my father back in Germany. It was there was a sense of, you know, the player's coach mindset that my father had. And it was a way also of including them when we were not sure of what to do with the pick and roll or with the screening action. And then my father was always like kind of, so what do you guys think? Like, what do you feel comfortable? What's your take on this situation? Because me and him were going back and forth about some things, which is normal. The coaching staff and the bigger coaching staff, you have even more opinions. But then you include the players, maybe not every time, but every now and then, like you have them. And then because it was their idea, they're even more bought in. And it's like, okay, we have to do this right, because otherwise it's not nobody else to blame but us.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like I like that, to throw it every now and then, to throw it onto the players and just include them in the decision making process. Yeah. That gives them an ownership part.
Yeah. It's funny you say that about pick and roll. So good at feeling the intensity of a non-switching ball screen situation. And so kind of as that evolved, it became, I kind of stepped back and was like, all right, we're not switching. You kind of feel it out in terms of, you know, personnel, want to be more aggressive or less aggressive, but also getting a feel for it. Like I remember playing against the Thompsons in the finals, who weren't great coming off screens and shooting, but every once in a while he would feel them really trying to turn the corner and surprise him with the hedge.
Yeah.
And kind of point being is I really stepped back in pick and roll defense and we didn't have any problems. So that, like, I really felt like that was a situation where in general, I think that's something that as coaches, we maybe go too deep into the rabbit hole and confuse the guys as opposed to like having a couple of general rules in terms of if he's more aggressive, you know, we're looking to do this on the backside. If he's less aggressive, we're looking to spray out to shooters. And kind of seeing how it plays out as opposed to trying to get in there and like dictate, now we're hedging, now we're flat. If it's a hedging, it's always this guy. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
It becomes paralyzation by analyzation.
That's yours.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. It's like you get paralyzed by overanalyzing it. And that's the essence of it. Like you overload the players with information, which might be correct, but it's not filtered out.
Yeah, or it's not natural. Sometimes I think there's things that happen on the basketball court that, with us not saying anything, if you're encouraging the defense to protect the basket, if my mindset is just protect the basket and you come right next to me, like, I'm going to do something to prevent you from going to the basket. I might swipe the ball away. I might step in front of you, as opposed to having very strict rules where, like, never strong side help. Never, you know what I mean? Never do this. Like, as opposed to if you're just like, hey, we're protecting the basket more or less. We want the position to be X, Y, or Z. But at its core, they're trying to go there. We're trying to keep them from going there. Like, let's hoop.
If I'm the devil's advocate, because some coaches that I know and some coaches I've worked with, but also some coaches that I know, they're so imminent on following the strict rules that they set, because it gives you a framework to also hold the players accountable. It's like, hey, if you just veer off a little bit of that, like this clear line, this is your fault. This is what you have to do. This is where, if we do it this way and it doesn't work, it's my fault.
Yeah.
You know, and then the coaches are strict with that frame just because it gives them a clear border. You know?
Yeah.
It gives them this is the red line.
Yeah.
You can't cross it.
Yeah.
And I'm agreeing with you. I'm on your side of it. I'm more like giving them 5% of this looseness, tightness. Mm. It has to be also the players that, with veteran players, it's much easier than with younger players. Where not all rookies or younger players that come to a higher level, professional level, that are going to get it right away. They have to have a natural feel for it.
So I would say I agree. For me, the art of coaching is this, like, figuring out what are going to be the criteria that I'm really going to hold people accountable for. And at the same time, allowing the players to feel like they're playing basketball and they're playing a sport and they're playing a team sport. But I wouldn't argue that it's only for the veteran players. I actually think that the younger players, sometimes we're overcoaching those guys and thinking that they can't do something or making things more complicated than it needs to be, as opposed to if you, especially on defense, like, encourage players to trust their instincts on defense. Like, on offense, sometimes, you know, we're willing to live with some turnovers and things like that. I think a lot of times on defense, we're not willing to live with mistakes. And then you're taking out the opportunity for guys to go make plays on defense and also feel empowered to go, you know, play basketball, get engaged on defense. It's much more fun, I think, if you have that freedom to go and make plays, as opposed to, like, all right, now we're coming to play in defense. It's got to be X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. I mean, there's also this theory that some teams are offensive minded teams, some teams are defensive minded teams, and then whichever one they are, for example, if there's a team that's much better on the defensive end and they dialed in, they play tough, they play hard all the time, you give them a lot more pull on offense, and you overlook some mistakes that they do because they play so hard on defense. So I think that's something that also has to be considered. And sometimes when you have to tighten the leash, when you have to let it go, depending on what type of team you have.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Giannis was in Maccabi, he was really, really excellent, I thought, of having clear ideas on defense.
Yeah.
And he didn't try to overcomplicate those ideas.
Yeah.
It was very, you know, it was just wonderful to watch, because he took over a team midseason and he came in and he had very, very clear ideas. And I think, you know, we're talking very much in generalizations. I think also, you know, when you take the team, if you get it midseason, if it's your roster, if it's not your roster, those things are all very important to take into consideration when you're deciding what are your tactical criteria. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's different if you can recruit the guys you want. You have these conversations over the summer. They've bought in, you've bought in to them. And then you can, you know, kind of start with a fresh slate, as opposed to, like, you're coming in midseason. You're obviously not coming into a great situation, because if, you know, a coach has been left. And so now how do you take control of that group? And I thought that, you know, the experience with Maccabi, with Giannis, of just watching him come in and, like, just take a team that was, you know, struggling at the time and then getting us into EuroLeague playoff contention, through super clear defensive criteria in a way that, like, was awesome.
Yeah, Giannis was my first mentor. That's somebody that I look up to, and that's somebody that I spend a whole lot of time with in the office. And because he came up through the military, right? He was a military person back in Greece before he was in basketball, and that really the way how structured he is, how dialed in is, how organized he is.
Yeah.
That only can lead to success.
Yeah.
That's the only way that really you can carve out a path to success. You know, other people get to success in a different way.
Yeah.
But if you're disciplined and you're organized like he is, it's going to eventually lead there.
Yeah. That's funny you say that, because now you saying that makes me remember that. So Rami Hadar, he was the head coach that took over, and he brought me in to Maccabi the first time. And he had a very similar defensive mentality of, like, his background was also in the military, and he also took control of the group kind of through defensive ideas and did a good job of that, and watching that evolve. And then Nevin came after that. Nevin was, you know, coming with an NBA kind of Euro mentality, and that had like a different blend. And then after him came Giannis. It was like this, you know, interesting sandwich of like military defense, NBA style, kind of military style defense. But yeah.
But how did you feel as an assistant coach throughout this whole period where there was so many changes in Maccabi in that one period?
Yeah.
You always had to redefine yourself as an assistant coach and feel out what the head coach wants, because it's really, I mean, every head coach wants something different from their assistant. Sometimes they don't want to get over-involved at all.
Yeah.
And sometimes they want to be proactive. It's hard.
Yeah.
You know, when you're staying with new coaches coming in, you're staying in the same team with the same players, you know the players. And the head coaches can utilize you also in a way where you've seen them enough. You know which things work with one player, don't work with the other one.
Yeah.
How did you find yourself? Did you feel comfortable with in each situation?
Yeah, I think as an assistant, one of the most important parts of that is helping the players improve and play well. And so, like, throughout that whole time, one of my main focuses was helping the players improve and helping the players play well. And so that was kind of something that I think as the head coach changed, I think that as an organization, they felt that I was doing that. And so, like, you know, you always want assistance. I believe that, like, if you can help the players improve and help them play well. And then in terms of communication with the head coach, I remember I'm somebody that, like, I'm not afraid to say an idea in the coach's room. I try to do that the most respectful way possible. And I remember with Nevin, I came in with something and he was like, let me see it. And I was like, okay. And I didn't have it ready. I had, you know what I mean? I had seen it 4 or 5 times. I had to go through my notes or something like that. And then I was like, you know, from that day on, any idea that I was going to present to the coach, or really any idea that I was going to try to push through to the group, whether that was as a head coach or as an assistant coach, I wanted to make sure that I had like evidence of that.
Yeah.
And so that was something that, then stuck with me and helped me to communicate with any coach, of just like figuring out the right time. You got to have an emotional intelligence. If they're coming in hot because they're dealing with something from the, you know, agents, players, signings, whatever, you know, different dramas that the head coach has to deal with, you got to figure out the right moment. But once you have that moment, if you're presenting it clearly, you have evidence behind it in terms of video, there's, you know, that's a pretty effective way to communicate with anybody in terms of like, coach, I think this is going to help us win. Or I think this is going to help us get an advantage. Or
this is why.
Yeah, and this is why. And here's those situations. Or I think that, you know, we're not playing enough of this situation in transition, or we're not getting to this enough late clock. And then you watch 5 of those clips from the last game or 2 games. Then it's a matter of like, okay, the head coach's decision of like, do we want to put our energy there or we don't? But the situation is real. It's not a fabricated like one time a game stuff.
Yeah.
And that was also something that, you know, in EuroLeague was super important, was going down the right rabbit hole. As you know, there's so many different tactical situations that can occur, of just trying to make sure that it's the right one to chase in terms of creating it more or finding a solution for. And if you don't have the evidence for it, as you know, sometimes it's hard to track that, because one important basket may have changed the game, but it actually wasn't as important in the result as the thing that happened 6 times where they switched with a certain position and you weren't ready for it. You didn't run and jump, or you let them play one-on-one, or whatever that outcome might be.
Exactly. The last shot was not necessarily the reason you lost.
Yeah.
It's everything that led up to it, where you had the same situation 6 times or 7 times, however you say, where you just couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
You couldn't figure out either on offense how to attack switches.
Yeah.
Or on defense, how to stop certain pick and roll actions. And you just kept getting mugged the whole time. Yeah. But let's rewind a little bit before we compare pros and young guys.
Okay.
You were a head coach at a young age in Spain.
Yep.
22 years old you were.
Yep.
And you became a head coach. You were, like, tell me about your living environment, why you chose where to live.
Yeah.
How you went about being a head coach at a young age.
Yeah.
You start learning Spanish. How you learned Spanish was very interesting to me as well.
Okay.
Because all the, you have a learning mindset. We have a growth mindset. Both. Yeah. That's why we get along.
We get along
on this trip most of the time.
Nah, it's been great.
So there are certain things that the learning can, that you do, and you have a structured like daily life where you take notes, you have a notebook with you all the time, just scribble down ideas when they come up, because they can come up, and comedians do that too. Because I listened to Joe Rogan a lot, and he said the best thing is when your idea pops into your mind, and this can be a basketball idea, but for him it was a comedy idea.
Yeah.
He's with his family at a dinner table, and as soon as the idea comes, he leaves, like he runs out.
Okay.
And either he records it on his phone, that's what he wants to talk about, or he writes it down, because it's just, it can evaporate.
Yeah.
Like that. So you carrying a notebook with you a whole lot of like everywhere that we go, and just being ready to scribble down notes, memories. How did the learning in Spain, especially as a young head coach, what did you learn the most? What things did you pick up on? What did you learn about yourself most of all?
Yeah. So, I mean, I knew I wanted to like coach at the highest level for a long time. As soon as I realized that probably wasn't in my cards playing wise, I really transitioned my mindset towards coaching. I remember that notebook stuff. I have notebooks in somewhere back in Oakland with like the triangle offense. Like when I was in high school, I was already kind of like very interested in how the triangle worked. But anyway, so after college, I knew I wanted to coach, and my option was to be a grad assistant at a D3 school at Whittier College, that I just got done playing for and wasn't like a powerhouse by any means, or to go overseas. And so I went overseas. It was a kind of a situation, as you know, I kind of, you know, finessed the door open. I went out there thinking I was going to be an assistant coach on a youth team. As you know, the club system in Europe, you have the youth teams, then you have the senior team, and that senior team can be in the NBA of that country, or it can be in a lower level. The club that I went to, the senior team was at a much lower level. I would say sixth or seventh division. Anyways, I thought I was going to be an assistant coach and kind of make some money from there, and I'd figure the rest of it out. And the first day that I showed up, the sports director was like, "Hey Tim, the head coach isn't coming. You know, everyone's semi-professional. People are making a little bit of extra money. Head coach is not coming. You know, you want to be the head coach?" And I was like, "Yeah, absolutely." So I kind of went outside, and I also knew one of the reasons why I went to Spain is I was like, I don't know how this basketball thing is going to work out, but at the very least, I'm going to learn Spanish, which I had taken Spanish in high school and college terribly, like just awful. And anyways, so I kind of, now I'm going to be the head coach of this team. Practice starts in like 15 minutes. I probably speak 100 words of Spanish fluently. So I kind of just go outside. I can remember exactly where I was sitting at in Castelldefels, Spain. And I was like, "All right, what am I about to say to these guys?" I was like, "All right." So we get in there. Hey, you know, they introduced me. "Hey, this is going to be Coach Tim." I get the guys together, and I was like, "Juntos, duros, positivos," which is juntos, together, duros, tough, positive. Three words, bring it in, start the practice. From there, it got, you know, Spanglish, some whistles, some yelling, some, you know, this, that, the other. But that was like the consistent message.
Foundation.
Yeah, the foundation. And it was something that is still something I try to reflect on, because with the limited vocabulary, I didn't have the opportunity to get my own way as a coach. So I had these three things that had nothing to do with the basketball, had to do with, you know, mindset, how you want to work with other people, how you want to take on challenges. And I think if you ask any of those players on that team, and I still talk with some of those guys pretty regularly, that stuck with them and that stuck with me. And it was a just a really impactful example of like clear messaging, using few words. And so that's how I started as a coach. And then during that time, I was doing the Spanish coaching certification, their licensing, their education, which is, I don't know the other countries, but it was absolutely amazing for somebody that was trying to become a basketball coach, just in terms of how they approach that. So during that process, and also, mind you, I've studied in high school John Wooden in terms of specifically with how he, how detailed he was with time. So I could tell you what happened in every practice every minute of every practice I've ever coached. Over like, I have those notebooks, and like anyone that's played for me or worked with me knows that like, as a head coach, like we're going to follow the plan as it relates to time. Now, I don't know if that's perfect or not perfect. That's how I was operating, in those, especially when I was in Europe and also at OTE. But, yeah, so I kind of got sidetracked.
But that's how Giannis was with his times.
Yeah.
Like when we were in Moscow together at CSKA, and he was the first assistant coach that I got to work with at that level. And he was keeping notes of every practice, kept the sheets, you know, like folded up every in folders. And he said, yeah, if you ask me what we did in Greece in 2001 in practice on November 18th,
he can tell you
he's gonna find that note.
Yeah, because it was super good. Oh yeah, so it was super good for like being able to reflect exactly like that. And so part of the Spanish coaching course, they give you a tutor. My tutor was Jota Cuspinera, who was with Real Madrid for a long time ACB head coach. And basically what's happening there is like you have certain criteria for the season in terms of like deciding your playing style, and then like an aspect of reflection, of like you're self-reflecting. And then I also had this expert coach who I could call, who I've now become very good friends with, Jota, because, you know, I was supposed to talk to him once a month or once every 3 months. And I was, you know, texting him every week or sending him an email or like asking him. And he was amazing in terms of helping me just work through things and like get things onto the court. But at its core, it established this kind of cycle of planning, executing, and reflecting.
Yeah.
Planning, executing, reflecting, and putting it on paper and going back and watching the film and doing all that kind of stuff. And so that was something that, you know, my first 7 years I'm in Spain as a head coach, and I was able to just like plan whatever felt like was going to be the most effective, execute it, and then reflect on it and just like kind of dial that in.
Kind of experimenting a little bit too, right?
Absolutely.
At that stage, I think that's kind of that's the most helpful way for a coach to grow, when you have this platform where you're not getting not necessarily criticized, but you don't have that many eyes on you.
Yeah.
Where you don't get paralyzed by that. You know?
Yeah.
A lot of times you start playing it safe. A lot of times I think that coach, when they feel like they have a lot of eyes on them, then they feel like they have too much to lose.
Yeah.
So they try to keep it safe, and then they don't have the platform to experiment and grow as a head coach.
But I'll say that, you know, one thing, like coaching at the youth level in Spain, and then, you know, different experiences in the States and then in EuroLeague, I think there's always external pressure. Like even these, you know, I'm in this small town in Spain, and, you know, some of the parents are not easy to deal with. They want to know why player X, Y, or Z is only playing 15 minutes and player R is playing, you know, 20, 25 minutes. And it's like, you know, so I think that how you deal with those things, obviously it's different if it's in the media and your family's waking up and they're looking at it also, but at its core, there's some kind of external, you know, thing coming at you, and you got to figure out how you're going to deal with it. Are you going to give it a bunch of attention? Are you going to deflect it? Are you going to take it head on? And, you know, every different, you know, external challenge. But I don't think that like all of a sudden you get to a certain level and there's external pressure, and on the way up to there's none. Like, I think that it's a progressive thing. And I think some coach maybe that does really well dealing with the media stuff, they might not be good with the random parent waiting for him outside the gym.
100%. It's a different type of pressure at every level.
Yeah.
It's a different type of pressure.
Yeah.
It's not good or bad. It's just different.
Yeah. Or I remember like even, you know, at one of the clubs in Spain, there was somebody that was like friends with the president. And so the president was like, hey, we want this, you know, this guy's got to play more. And like, how do you deal with that? Which I think in Europe is, you know, something that happens where for whatever reason, a certain player needs to be on the court. And that can be because he's friends of the president. That can be because he's a fan favorite. Mm-hmm. And sometimes as a coach, you got to get in the locker room, get in the club, and figure out, again, what's the best way forward for the team, for the club, for all these things. And it's like, as you know, it's a freaking matrix that you got to like, you got to be mobile. You got to be agile, man. You got to find the solution.
You constantly have to be on your toes.
Yeah.
Dynamic.
Yeah.
And then you're good at that too. I mean, I've noticed that in Cartagena that you're good on your toes and like, rolling with the punches, but also, being, elastic. You know?
Yeah.
Like like you just have to be aware of who's trying to get like in Cartagena. For the people who don't know, you're constantly have to haggle, or you get haggled for certain prices for certain things that you want. And Tim has been probably the one person in the world that I've met that can deal with all those situations at hand spontaneously as they get presented to you. Just got quick with your mind to anticipate, because you had also experience in that growing up in Oakland. You told me that you were able to, like, street smart. Like, it's a lot of street smarts that's involved in that.
Yeah, I had some different experiences there. And then, you know, one of the most impactful as it relates to is just going to A's games and being on the BART ramp and scalping tickets and figuring out, you know, what's the best way to get the best price for the ticket to get into the game. And then, you know, that's something that I've kind of experienced a lot, as my friends know from home, and from doing that. And it's kind of stuck with me. And as soon as, like, I realized that, you know, in Colombia in general, but in Cartagena specifically, that, like, that's going on all the time with everything, I was like, all right, that's how we're going to play. Like, let's, you know, all right,
this is my game.
The first day you guys kind of caught me off guard, but if that's what's going on, then we can do that. You guys
they don't know what they got themselves into.
Yeah, they're like, who's this gringo? Like, what's this? What, speaking Spanish? Yeah. Like, how did that happen? But yeah.
There was a lot of locals that had to chalk it up to the game, to a gringo.
Because it was a fair deal. It was a fair deal. That's what we talked about. Like, that's how it's going to play out. We don't need to, you know.
That's something that I have not learned growing up in Germany. That's something that you don't grow up with.
A little different
approach
to it.
That's why this trip is so special, because I see a totally different side, not only of you, but also of the world. I mean, I've known this exists, and it's probably extreme in some other areas of the world as well.
Yeah.
But I've never had to deal with it at hand constantly on a basis where it was just like, this goes against the nature that I grew up in Germany, in the culture. Where everything is very precise rules, clear framework, and you can't step outside the line. If you get stepped outside the line, it's like less flexibility. Now I'm growing up, and I sense that also is not the right way. For certain things, it is. For work, it's probably good to have that, but you still have to have that flexibility.
Yeah, I don't think there's right or wrong. I think it's just an awareness of, like, different environments require different skill sets or mindsets to be successful. Yeah. And you got to be able to, or go to the place where your mindset is going to be and your skill set is going to be most effective, or you got to be adaptable where, like, in a certain situation, you got to, you know, show them you got a knife in your, you know, not that much, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
you have to play the cards right.
And, like, you got to play your cards
with
right.
The Ace games, like, you go $10 bill in one and $20 bill in the other pocket.
Yeah.
And
that's I would be going 5 and 10.
Yeah.
But it's like, you don't want to negotiate a price. You're like, hey, I already got this $5 and you pull out a 20. Like, you're not going to be a good spot. So you got to have a game plan going into it. You got to, you know a little bit, as we talked about yesterday, like, knowing a little bit of the market, knowing a little bit about what the environment's going to be. That was one of the hardest things about, you know, negotiating the boat back or figuring out if we could find a boat back yesterday was, like, I had no idea what was going to be out there, but when we got out there, it was what it was.
But that was like, we go out there with an Uber and have no idea of how to get back. And then all of a sudden we end up on the speedboat on the way back
with the music playing
for $15. Like, I mean, that's something that was for me, this day yesterday deserves a chapter in my book whenever I'm going to write. Like, it's a separate chapter, the Cartagena chapter.
Let me give you a little foreword.
So you, because of the Spanish experience for 6 years, you said you were there?
I was in Spain for 6 years. Yep. 5 in the Barcelona area and then 1 in Canaries Academy.
Okay. And now you have a project that you do with the Spanish Federation, right? Like, they have it in their curriculum. Did this Spanish course for basketball coaches, did this idea derive from that time, or why did you end up doing this?
So when I started in Spain at this level that I was talking about, I wasn't making enough money to make ends meet. I was living in a small room about this big and, you know, Cas Davies Ball, small town in Spain. And I was teaching English on the side. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I was doing basketball. I was, like, there all day working at the club, doing stuff with the kids. And then Tuesday and Thursday, I was giving private English classes. So I was running around hustling, one-on-one classes, worked at an academy in the town. And that kind of stuff. And that became relevant because along the way, I got really interested in, like, web design and basically designing learning platforms that could be used for the English courses. So, like, I didn't want to have to print out a sheet every time I wanted to be able to just send people links. You know what I mean? So I was, like, creating these different activities for my English students to practice when I'm not there. So then they're, you know, more engaged. They're getting better quicker. They're happier with their experience with me as a teacher. And then I was also doing that with the basketball team. So I can remember having, you know, when the iPod Touch was there, I was showing players, this is like 2007. Some of these guys remember like video of themselves. I was paying some, you know, kid at the club to film the game. And I was going home and cutting the game, putting it on an iPod Touch and showing the players video. But anyway, so at its core, it was like this, you know, very early on creating kind of learning platforms and using video and that kind of stuff. And that kind of evolved to a curriculum to learn English through basketball that now I have a relationship with the Spanish Basketball Federation that they're using that platform inside of their coaches certification program.
So that's one project that you have on the side that you are also stimulates your mind creatively as well, but you're also helping people at the same time.
Yeah.
You also, I remember back then when we met, when you were in New Zealand, you also had a scouting platform that got you to New Zealand job, more or less. I mean, that was one.
To that G League job.
The G League job.
Yeah.
Okay, so explain that.
So, you know, I was using these different kind of like web development tools and figuring out like how to do different things as it relates to like websites and video and questions and quizzes. And I got really into Moodle, which is like an open source learning platform that a lot of universities use. But long story short, so when I went to Canaries now after 6 years in Spain, and this was a big jump for me. I'm sorry, 5 years in Barcelona. Now I go to Canary Islands, and this was my first full basketball job. The 5 years leading up to that, I was doing this basketball and English stuff. So I get there and I built out this platform, this kind of like thing inside of Adobe. Adobe has amazing tech tools that I think a lot of coaches now are using, whether it be Photoshop or InDesign or Lightroom as you use, but anyways, inside of InDesign, you could create this kind of like EPUB that had videos and information. So I had like our playbook and our scouting reports and our post-game report inside of basically an app. It wasn't an app, but it was basically an app, for the team. And so I had two iPads and I would just have those at the table during practice. And if a player didn't remember a play, they could go and refer to it there with video. Sometimes I would put stuff on there and the players, as they entered into the practice, they would need to look at it and could be something fun, could be something related to tactics, could be whatever. And then after those, you know, my whole mindset when I was in Europe was, as long as I'm moving up, I'll stay out here. And I gave myself 2 years, every 2 years. So I couldn't be anywhere for 3 years. That was because I was like, look, I have a college education. I'm not making any money. I'm out here, you know, basically teaching English and doing this on the side, even though I'm dedicating, you know, 6 or 8 hours to basketball, doing every practice plan down to the minute, post-practice review every day, every player, how they play, all this kind of stuff. Was wonderful. I loved it, but also realized like, okay, I can't do this for the rest of my life. I need to make sure that I'm progressing to, you know, not be coaching in the seventh division when I'm right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, so long story short, this is kind of at the time of the, the financial crisis in Spain. And I saw very clearly after the Canaries experience, like the next job for me was kind of like LEP Silver assistant coach. And as the economy went down, you know, those jobs were definitely not going to the foreign American guy. They're going to the, you know, the coach from the club.
Yeah.
And, you were that pool. And so I was like, okay, I got to come back to the States. So I'm back in the States. I'm at Summer League. Remember this summer very well with Danny Mills, both of us coming from Europe looking for a job at Summer League, which is probably like the worst possible experience as a basketball coach ever. It's like going to Summer League and looking for a job. If you don't have a job, you have a job and you're trying to like get another one. Okay. It can be different, but like going there. So anyways, so I'm there and I remember very specifically with one team, I had some kind of like small connection to the coach of the Summer League team. I was at my brother's apartment, screen recording the game every quarter, pulling that onto the desktop, cutting the game up into like, you know, different tactical stuff, putting those clips into the custom app, right? For the whole game. So like pick and roll, all their sets, early different stuff, taking this app, waiting for the head coach of the Summer League team at the hotel. So he gets back from the hotel. Mind you, this is 2012, 2013. So, and being like, hey, coach, you know, here's the game. And I remember he looked at it. He looked at the apps. This is like, you know, it's custom. It's freaking team logo, whatever, something I built. And he looks at the video and he's like, oh man, the video doesn't scrub. Like you couldn't, you know, you couldn't smoothly fast forward, rewind, or go slow-mo.
And that was
the, and kind of hands it back to him. And I was like, dang, like you don't see any
that any
no
value?
No value in the hustle. Like no, like literally I got the game before the video guys do.
Yeah.
And I'm looking for anything. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying anyways. So that didn't work out well. I did that for a couple of games and I was like, this dude is just like not, they're not feeling it. I saw it wasn't the right connection. So I put on did an application online. Sam Hinkie had just gotten the Sixers GM. And I think he's very much, you know, outside the box thinker. So I did an online application, for the 76ers. And one of the key points of that application, you know, you could put some screenshots. So I put the screenshot of the app that I'd built in Canaries Academy. And, then when I did ended up doing the interviews with Sachin, who's now with the Timberwolves, I know that was a point of like interest. Like, well, tell me about this app. And anyways, I was able to parlay that into a G League, assistant coaching job, which is where I met Kevin. And now I'm obviously with Kevin at BYU.
That's, you know, those things are unpredictable, man.
How super unpredictable.
And I was going to ask that later. Sliding door moment. That's a sliding door moment right there.
Yeah. Like, and I don't think there's a lot of people that have gotten an NBA coaching job from an online application. Like zero connection to anybody. Just like,
I'm just going to go ahead and write that email.
Teamworks online. Cool. But yeah, that's how that worked out. So that, I think that like app that I created, or that tool at its core, it's like a learning tool. Was very important in drawing interest to, you know, an NBA team.
It sets a precedent.
President of the country?
No.
Hey, everybody, quick time out. Just wanted to introduce ProBalls.com to you. Just quick commercial break because we didn't have the tools available to us to look through the ProBalls.com website as we're recording this episode. So I wanted to just urge you quickly to go to ProBalls.com as the season is beginning soon in France this weekend. I would like you to go to ProBalls.com, visit the different stats that they have available, the different searches they have available, follow your favorite teams, follow your favorite players, just put a like to them and it's going to spit out the stats for you right away as you visit the website. They have a whole bunch of searches available. And if you're not there yet, you should go to ProBalls.com and enjoy that experience. Meanwhile, enjoy this conversation as we continue. Thank you. Bye.
It just sets a baseline for success.
Yeah.
Like you set yourself up for success.
Yeah.
It's a good foundation to, like I said earlier with Giannis, like if you have a foundation that you have principles that you follow, and in this case it was an app, like you were hustling, you were putting in the effort. And I'm a strong believer that hustle and hard work, discipline that you followed, eventually somebody's gonna pick up on it.
Yeah.
Eventually somebody's gonna see it.
Yeah.
If you are just trying to finagle your way, Zach Lowe has this word, finagle.
Okay.
Finagle your way through, like, he uses it in the basketball context, but you can use it in any type of way.
Yes.
And I think if you try to finagle your career, that's not going to work. You know, if you are persistent and you work, you believe in what you do and you work hard, and it's eventually there's going to be a crack in the door somewhere and you're going to get the chance, you know, like, I know because I've experienced that way. I was not aiming, and people ask me like, "How did you build your career? What were the steps that you were following?" I was just focused in on what I'm doing now. I was trying to be great at what I was doing at that time. I did not think about getting an NBA job.
Yeah,
Austin was the one who picked me up. He saw me, and it was a random situation as well. It was a sliding door moment. I met him in a under 18 in Warsaw, and that day I could have just sat somewhere else on the opposite side of the court and not have met him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he introduced himself to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like I went up to him. I didn't know who he was. So it was just kind of a lot of those things aligned. But I was there because I was working for Cesca at that time, but I didn't have to be determined. I just wanted to work. I just wanted to spend the time, the summer, traveling the youth tournaments, seeing which next generation is going to come up, because Tesco's not going to sign an 18-year-old, 17-year-old. So I was just kind of doing it for my own sake, but also for the club's sake, for the future, just to see who's coming up. And then you're doing the work, somebody's going to pick up on it. Someone's going to see it. Someone's going to draw you up. Yeah. And you just be yourself.
Yeah.
That's my, I was being myself and I never tried to be somebody. I was never trying to look super professional or active in a hyper.
Yeah, you were trying to do the job. I was trying to do the job,
but also do it with my own personality, the way I know. And my personality, I want my personality to reflect in every possible area of my life, because that's the way I want to live, you know. And then if when I'm coaching hard, I'm coaching my butt off. I love the competition part. When I'm scouting, I'm traveling, I'm talking to people, I'm doing that 100%. But my personality is supposed to shine in all of those areas.
Yeah, you gotta be authentic.
Yeah,
you gotta be yourself.
That 100%. That's the only way.
100%.
So you had these different experiences at different levels in different cultures, whether it's Israel, whether it's the G League, whether it's in Spain, now in OTE, now in college, which you're gonna start now. So it's not like really that we can talk about much, but in general, across the board with all those experiences you had with the different cultures, do you have a common denominator there that you feel like that translates at every level? It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
Where it is in the world.
Like, I mean, I think that keeping it simple. I think that especially, you know, if we're talking about basketball coaching, keeping it as simple as possible, like figuring out what are going to be your tactical criteria and sticking to those and not overcomplicating it. And obviously at the EuroLeague level, that's going to be different than at a youth level, but there's still a way to do it at that level where there's tons of tactics and tons of ways of doing it simply and doing it complicated. So I think that keeping it simple is super, super important. And then in terms of like, as you just touched on, just being yourself, like we all know that players especially can smell a phony.
Yeah.
So if you try to be somebody else, if I tried to be Rami or Nevin or Giannis or Avi, you know, who's also a Maccabi, who's a dear friend of mine, who's somebody I look up to, I have no chance. And I know that. I just got to be myself and do it. And I think that any coach has to do it. And I think that's something it's not like a secret.
No.
A lot of people are saying that. A lot of people understand that. Sometimes it's harder to do because the person that you're maybe being mentored by or you've seen do it, they handle it a different way. And so in terms of like going into that situation and providing a solution that you've never seen, I think that's where it comes into play. Some of these travel experiences where like, you know, if you go out and you wanted to go do something, you know, in Cartagena, you're gonna have to find a solution for it. You know what I mean? It's a situation you've never been in, and your solution is gonna be different than my solution.
100%, no doubt about that one.
but I think that, you know, to answer that question, it's like keeping it as simple as possible, and there you gotta like reflect on your tactical awareness. No, of like I can keep it simple, and I can ask the players to do something that is not going to help them be successful. And that's also not going to work. Like you have to be very, you know, smart tactically in terms of the players. This is also some kind of coming back to what we talked about earlier in terms of staying alive at a club like Maccabi throughout different coaching changes. At its core, I was very focused that when I communicated with the players, I really wanted for their experience to be, this guy's helping me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do a lot of extra stuff there. I didn't talk about a lot of extra stuff because in that environment, everyone's super busy. You're in this bustling city. You got game. They got families. You got all this stuff going on. I'm not, you know, there's not a lot of time for 5-10 minutes of small talk. Okay. Sometimes there is, but at its core, I was really focused on them having the experience of if I come talk with Tim before the game or at practice or sit and watch film with him, that's going to help me play better. Because firmly believe every player at every level wants to play well. No one's coming into practice like, oh man, I want to have a terrible practice today. If they do, then they shouldn't be in your locker room. But for the most part, everyone's coming in, I want to play well. I want to practice well. I want to have a good experience. Now it's a matter of them coming from wherever they're coming from, coming into the gym, can you get that message across? And it might be in a different language. It might be in a different style for a different player. Maybe for one player, you do have to develop a little bit more of a personal relationship before they allow you to come at them with some tactical details. But at its core, it's a matter of like, when I'm talking to this coach, is he helping me play well? And I think if that answer is yes, then you're going to be in a good spot. And that's something I definitely focused on.
That's one thing that a lot of coaches forget, is that you can learn a lot from players as well.
100%.
And a lot of times some coaches have older players, veteran players, and you have to find a way to connect with them and listen to them and be humble enough to understand that their experience is much, sometimes more valuable on the court for you also to help the team win. I remember in Germany also, that was I was still a young coach. I just finished playing because of injuries, and I was more frustrated than anything, emotionally irrational. But he was like
Uncle Rico in Napoleon Dynamite.
Worse. Yeah.
Wow.
And players have seen me flip out. Like I have zero patience. To some extent, I do have patience, but when my truth collides with a genuine wrongness, that I see that this is not how it's supposed to be, I lose my shit.
Yeah.
Like I can't say it another way. And there was a way. It was in Germany. There was some hiccups that I had, but there's one player that I respect, Martin McGee. He was a winner. He was a winner on all levels he played at, and he was like, "Kiss." You know, I never knew that expression, kiss, keep it simple, stupid. You know, like, just don't overcomplicate things.
Yeah.
And like you said, across all cultures, I think that can be replicated on all levels. Just keep it simple.
And that was something that, like, at Maccabi was wonderful, because you're dealing with players that, you know, like, guys that come to mind for me are like Devin Smith, Othello Hunter, that they've been around the world and back and had worked for amazing coaches. So they get it. So they're like, if you can figure out how to communicate with them, they gave me some amazing just advice, feedback, just in the natural flow of conversations of, you know, showing more interest in one area than in others, because they knew that that was what was going to help them be more effective. And so, yeah, just as you said, just learning from the players is like, just something that we all should be open to as coaches. And I don't think it's exclusive to experienced players. I think that was something that I took from OTE, was that, you know, players are coming in with their reality.
Yeah.
I can't help them see basketball through a EuroLeague lens. It's never going to happen. It's the wrong road to go down.
Mm-hmm.
I got to figure out how to see it through their lens. And one of the most important ways that I can see it through their lens is having an open line of communication, you know, with what they're experiencing and what they're feeling and all that kind of stuff.
And I think that's what you're touching on. I think that to be able to put yourself in other people's shoes, other players, see it from their lens, see it from their perspective, is emotional intelligence. But learning, traveling, experiencing different cultures, I call it a spectrum of people, learning how they live, learning how they think.
Yeah.
The more people you see, the more people you can understand. They might not understand you because they haven't seen as much as you have.
Yeah.
But you can understand them, and then you can put yourself in their shoes.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay. And you have a lot more comparisons.
Yeah.
Going. And that's how you can connect the players as well. Yeah. You have them. It's like in a relationship. Like, you feel way more comfortable if the other person understands you and where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Like, you're allowed, you're able to express yourself, and the other person knows that you know what you're talking about. And that's when the player-coach relationship takes off.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, the first thing that comes to mind when talking about that is rookies in Europe.
Mm.
I think that that's one of the biggest just like misses going both directions, of like a high-profile rookie or any rookie really, but they're coming from a college program where clearly if they're going to Europe, they were very successful. So they were the man in college, on campus, big man on campus, like understanding what that experience is. A lot of these colleges have tremendous resources. So you got like rebounders and managers and cafeterias and food available and like tutors to help you and just like tons of support. And then you're coming to Europe to a club that has tons of pride, and maybe they're super successful and they're like, hey, we're, you know, club X, Y, or Z. We've won, you know, 3 championships in the last 6 years. So like, you should come in here with a proper amount of like, you know, respect for the club, respect for the, you know, the city, our fans. And these players are coming in like, you know, and it's just like a miss. You know what I mean? And it's just simply a matter of like, just a little bit of the club maybe not fully understanding what's, you know, the experience of a college basketball player. And the college basketball player coming in at 21, 22, starting to get paid, first job professional, new country, new this, no idea about what the club is or any kind of stuff right there. And then, you know, there can be a miss right there. And then that's why it's so hard, I think, for rookies to make it in Europe, and especially rookies that can't come from like high profile programs, just because it makes it more difficult. Cause you know, the way it's set up in Europe, it's different. You know, you might have to partner shoot even at the highest level where you're rebounding for your teammate, which like for a college player is not something they've done for the last 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a mind shift. And that's a lot of also you're putting yourself in their shoes, also making them understand, but there's no other way. They're going to have to adjust.
They got to adjust.
But also the team has to adjust to them to make like meet them halfway. In some instances, maybe further out that way.
Yeah.
Some instances, they like early on, they need some help.
Yeah.
And we had in Germany, because we're at the second division level, the club made sure they sent me, because the first person they meet speaks fluent English. They have a comfort level. They can connect with me. I was able to drive them around. I was able to show them around the city because it was my city. And I had keys to the city, basically. Yeah. I'm just kidding. But it made life easier. For the players, it's just easy. And they come into the apartment. The refrigerator is full of food.
Yeah.
They don't have to go shopping, figure things out. Yeah. You know, everything was set up. It's a smooth landing.
Yeah.
And then you let them, like, it's like raising, I don't have kids, but like baby steps, you know, one here, and then they're comfortable. They can go there. They can maybe fail at one shopping store, not being misunderstood. Yeah. They learn from that.
Yeah.
But also they have to be open to new cultures.
And I think that's something where it's so key, the communication leading up to arrival. I think so many times in the recruitment, the picture and the discussion is always around kind of the high end of how this could play out, as opposed to what I think is super important is you talk about the floor. Like, this is probably what it's going to look like day by day. You know, are you going to have problems partner shooting? And if you ask them that in July before they sign the contract, it's different than after a 5-on-5 in scrimmage. All right, partner shoot. Dude just didn't get two foul calls because he got fouled by the veteran of the team. And now he's got a partner shoot for the first time in 4 years. Like, and he's, you know, it's coming out of the blue like that. But it's something that very simply could be avoided.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, this is different than college. Like, this is a scenario. How are you can be okay with that scenario? Mm-hmm. And most of the time you talk to the player beforehand. Yeah, they're good. And that's where it goes back to just like, this communication, what are expectations? And again, I always refer to this, like, talk about the floor. You might not start. Talk about it in July. Don't talk about it in, you know, tell him he's going to start. You're going to be the main player.
Yep.
And then he shows up and then the coach is, you know, has a different idea and you got this situation and you got the agent involved. And there's like all these dynamics of like talking about the floor and kind of what we talked about at the beginning, really being smart on getting the right people in the locker room. And then from there, I think that everything, will.
Yes, expectation level. Like it has to be a certain type of expectation, have a realistic view on things and not have an overblown idea of what it's going to be like. I'm going to be the superstar. And then all of a sudden you're just going to be one of many foreigners that are going to be on a team. It's going to be more of a democracy. Everybody's going to have to contribute and you're not going to have the ball in your hands the whole time. So tell me about the adjustment process when you left Europe and you went to OTE. Going from high level, high end EuroLeague to coaching young prospects in the
States. Yeah. So I think that, you know, EuroLeague players, these guys are super formed. They're super developed. They're super kind of evolved as professional basketball players. Like they have amazing mindset coming in day to day. They understand what it is to play on a team, to be a part of a team, especially at the EuroLeague level where you're not depending on any one player. It's very much team mentality. And so in order to help them, you need to figure out like the smallest tactical details that can help them be successful or be more successful than what they are, because they're already successful. They're at the EuroLeague level. They've already had, you know, a tremendous amount of success. And then going to, you know, coaching young American players for the most part that are getting paid now for the first time. So they're, in their mind, they're professional. And some of them, they're missing I use this like example of cake. So at the EuroLeague level, they already got the cake. You're trying to figure out like, is there a better cherry that you can put on top? A lot of them already have a cherry. Maybe you just got to turn the cherry like this. Going to, you know, overtime, these guys have a lot of the cherries, but they're missing the cake, but they want the cherries. So it was like trying to figure out how to help them to have the right mindset coming into practice. And there it goes down to, you know, with a young player, and I think especially with my experience with the young American players is like, you need to have a relationship with them for them to trust you and listen to you. Whereas like a yearly player, they get it. They're coming into the gym and for the most part, they're going to listen to you. Now, if you talk to them about something that doesn't make any sense, they're going to stop listening to you very quickly. But like from day one, it's much more, I think, simple and direct in terms of like coaching them. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the States, you know, I'm coming to right there. That's one of the reasons why I think I was able to connect better with, you know, Alex and Ethan right at the beginning was because they had more of a European mentality. But anyways, of like figuring out the route to get them to trust you, to listen to the things that are actually going to help you be successful as a pro, which is getting in there early, being on time for everything, having maximum effort for, you know, as much time as possible in a practice, you know, doing the things off the court that allow you to come into there. If you're not sleeping at night, if you're not eating well, you're not going to be able to have a great practice. And so, you know, these guys are now first time pros thinking they're on a step one, two NBA. And now all of a sudden they're getting coached very directly by somebody that they've never met. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It was a big challenge. Yeah. And so I think just like it was a really good learning experience for me of figuring out that like for certain players, you can't just coach them from day one. You got to figure out how to get them to trust you. And, you know, at that particular place, you know, I wasn't involved in the recruitment. So like sometimes the first time we had a basketball conversation was the first day of practice. So, it was a unique experience. It was a wonderful experience, but I think that in general, it was just like this cake analogy of like, you know, the early guys, they got the cake. Can you give them a better cherry? Cool. Great. You know, figuring that out. And then at the OTE level, it was like trying to help them
build the cake,
yeah. But they want the cherry. Yeah. So now you got to like, you know, figure out what does that conversation look like? And also all the people involved, you know, now, especially with the younger players, like agents, family members, just kind of people around the player, figuring out how to get them aligned. Cause you're not going to, you know, you, as much as you want to be the main voice, that might not be the reality for a certain player. So figuring out what stakeholders are involved and trying to get some kind of alignment in terms of what are the criteria? What are the simple things that we really want to hold this player accountable for or really emphasize to help them get to the next level? Was a tremendous contrast.
Interesting. You have to help them cook.
Yeah.
Like just learn how to cook, learn how to build their own cake.
Or to feel like they need to cook. Cause they're telling me, hey coach, let me cook. And I'm like, I want to let you cook, but just be on time. Just like play through a foul.
Yeah.
You can't stop playing. You can never stop playing. You have to keep playing. You have to keep playing. You have to keep showing up if you want to be successful. Cause if you stop, someone else is not going to stop. And I think especially in the States, an understanding of like how many players want what you're trying to get. It's bigger than what you see. There's people all around the world that are really working right now very hard to try to get the same thing. And so you got to bring it every day. And if you don't bring it, somebody else going to be just as big, just as strong, just as skilled. And whoever has a better mentality is going to win out. And unfortunately, so many young players think that they are the next LeBron because in their 14 or 15 year old league or 16 year old league, they are LeBron.
Yeah.
But it, as we all know, as you go up, it looks different.
Cream rises.
The guy in front of you looks different. All of a sudden, he looks just like you. All of a sudden, he's a little bigger than you. So now if he's bigger than you and he's faster than you and you've only relied on that your whole career until now, you never develop this idea of, you know, perseverance or grit. You're setting yourself up for failure. So it's like, as a coach, how can you try to, you know, develop those skills in a young player where they're focused on like, they need their step back. Coach, I need to work on my step back. Great. You do. But what's really going to help you is when you get fouled, can you get back and get the rebound?
Mm-hmm.
Can you next time, you
know, get back into the play?
Get back into the play. Can you make the right decision after, you know, something bad happens? After a turnover, can you still, you know, play with confidence and not get shaky and like, you know, those type of things. And sometimes they're not, you know, coming into the gym, looking, seeing basketball through the same, you know, through the same lens. And then it's a matter of like, as we talked about before, of me trying to understand as a coach, I can't get them to see it through my lens. I need to figure out how they're seeing the game and try to adapt that message to get them to align based on how they're seeing the game.
It's great. You ready for my ETOs?
Now I'm ready. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you're ready.
I'm ready. Now I'm ready.
Now we're both ready. I'm going to shoot some things at you. I'm going to try to think of some things that I think people can relate to and learn from. What would be your top three books that you read that you feel like is a good foundation? Not necessarily basketball, but
yeah,
learning.
Yeah. I would say Growth Mindset by Carol Dweck. That's like a must read. It's just talking about kind of this idea of just how to, you know, approach things with a growth mindset and understanding that everything as it relates to learning and ability, not everything, I can't get taller as much as I try, but many, many things, more things than we think you're able to improve on if you have the right approach to it. I would say The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand, which is just a wonderful book. And there's one character in that book, Howard Roark, who is just like,
It's a novel.
Yeah. I don't want to say he's an amazing friend, but I've read that book maybe five or six times. And it's, at this point, I think he is a fictional friend of mine, which is a great character in terms of like, you know, how to approach success and sticking to your standards and sticking to what motivates you and what you think is correct and true. And, that's the second one. And the third one, I would say, maybe The Alchemist or Fab Five, which are two very different books, but that would be
opposite
sides of the spectrum. Yeah.
What's one of your biggest pet peeves? One as a coach and one as a person.
As a coach, I would say if we start talking out of both sides of our mouth of like, and I think there's tons of examples of that, but like asking players to do one thing and then, you know, setting criteria for another one, or just
what do you mean, double standards?
Or yeah, double standards, or just like asking for two things that don't necessarily align,
mm-hmm.
and then trying to, you know, give feedback to the team or the players on both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be misalignment.
Mm-hmm.
As a coach, like misalignment, that'd be a better phrasing of it. And as a person, would be when you are in the bar or restaurant and you've ordered food and a drink and they bring you the Coca-Cola and they pour all of the Coca-Cola into the cup before the food comes. Cause then when the food comes, your Coke is flat and that's not good. If I'm ordering a Coca-Cola, I want to have that fizz factor at the time of food.
That's what I learned this trip too. Respect the fizz.
Respect the fizz. And I think whoever has purchased or is going to consume that drink should be able to manage the fizz as they want. I would much rather prefer get a little splash of the fizz at the beginning. And then I have, you know, still the ice cold, unmelted. Yeah.
Something you feel like is still your weakness and you have to improve on the most as a coach, as a person.
Mm. As a person, I think, man, that's a good question. You didn't give me these.
No, I don't give them to anybody.
Don't give them to anybody?
No, it's ATOs. Like I don't give my ATOs out.
That would be compromising the
podcast. That would be compromising the podcast.
And you're not compromising nothing.
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 Okay.
This could be the same thing. It could be, you know, sometimes the personality reflects also in the coaching aspect. So it could be one and the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's just a different context.
Yeah. I think, as we've talked about, just like finding the right balance of being carefree and being professional. I think that's for me.
To find the balance between the two. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I think that, you know, that's something that I just need to continue to be mindful of and continue to find the right balance of, because I do very much enjoy my life. I enjoy traveling. I enjoy, you know, spontaneous things. And then, you know, at its core, I want to be a great basketball coach. Yeah. It's motivated me for so long. And so just understanding and continuing to be aware of the fact that like, you got to you know, have your priorities set and making sure that the main thing is the main thing.
That's it. Main thing is the main thing. Draw the line at some point to extend, because I'm the same.
Yeah.
And sometimes the line can get blurry.
Yeah.
And the challenge is, I'm adding on to the ATO now, but the challenge is to recognizing that situation.
Yep.
You know, because sometimes you get carried away and then all of a sudden in hindsight, like, oh, I should not have, you know, went that far, or I shouldn't have done this. So recognizing in that the significance of the moment, which can be a trickle down effect later on.
And that main thing, the main thing is like something that I referred to a lot with players, because sometimes you start talking to them and the conversation can start to go to some other place. And then it's like, okay, or let's talk about that now and then we'll come back to the main thing, or let's leave that for now. Let's make the main thing the main thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so like just kind of keeping, being aware of that, is something that I want to continue to improve as a person and as a coach. I think, leaning into my experiences non-tactically.
Okay. So just in terms of connecting with players.
If I'm gonna keep it 100%, man, in the interview process.
Yeah.
I've been in some interviews and I've tried to like get people to see the game and be like, okay, you know what? That plan is better than that plan. And it's like, at the end of the day, there's so many good coaches. There's so many good plans, so many good ideas and approaches for player development or for the team or how to play offense and defense that like, that's not my strength. Yeah. My strength is the fact that I speak four or five languages, coaching in different places. And so I think that like leaning more into that would be something that as a coach I want to do. And also in the communication with the players of just like,
100%. I mean, you said this is the essence of coaching, that your experiences that you have in life reflect in the coaching, in the person, in the connection with the players, using the metaphors from your life experience, from what you saw, and applying them into a coaching context is priceless.
Yeah.
And I said it to you yesterday. I said André Trinchieri is probably one of the best metaphorical coaches, where he can relate one thing to another and make it a rainbow color, where other coaches are very black and white.
Yeah.
Lots of gray area there, but that adds a lot of color to their understanding of the game. If you can reflect your experiences, you can recognize those things and apply them in the coaching aspect. It's the last thing. Tim Ferriss question. You know that one. That's not a big secret. What's your favorite failure in the past, where you've learned from the most, but you failed at, but you felt like that's the biggest lesson you had and you had to have to grow from that?
I haven't listened to Tim Ferriss in a while,
but you listen to my podcast in a while, and I ask that every, I'm putting you on the spot here. I ask that every podcast, almost every podcast.
Almost.
I left that loophole open.
My favorite failure is probably, I've had a few failures, like big ones, that have just kept the fire burning. And so I think that, just being able to like take on a challenge, take on somebody saying no to me, especially as it relates to basketball, and using that as motivation to continue to try to be my best self as a coach. Like I was going to get cut from my high school team, transferred, coming out of high school then. So I transferred. We beat them in the state championship playoffs, which was a side story. You dropped that in. And then coming out of high school, like literally nobody recruited me. Like nobody. I had to ask a friend's dad who played at a D3 to call the coach. I went and showed up for the recruiting visit. Coach wasn't there. You know what I'm saying? Like that type of stuff. Coming out of college, I finessed my way into this opportunity in Spain. You know what I mean? So it was just like this constant people kind of being like, no. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, I mentioned a few of those of like about to get cut, not getting recruited in college, coming out of college, no opportunities, kind of making an opportunity. But at its core, it's just like,
persistency.
Yeah. Just persistence. And like, there's different things that have happened along the way, much smaller things that when they happen, I get really frustrated and then I sit down and kind of think to myself or write. And I'm like, nah, it's just, this is what's supposed to be happening. Like you gotta re-up. you got to refill the gas tank. You got to just push through it and find the way through this. Yeah. So those are some of the failures.
That's cool. No, it's
I don't think I've shared some of those things with anybody other than the people that were there at the time.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
How can people find you? I mean, this is the best location to film. You can find you now in Cartagena, but how can people find you?
Yeah, just go to Cartagena and look for me, man. There's some,
on the street
blonde dude that's speaking fluent Spanish that's, you know, got some access to a boat. No, I would say the best way is on Instagram.
Instagram.
Tim Fanning 510.
Why 510?
That's the area code of Oakland, California. Home of the Athletics for the next few months.
It's been a pleasure, man.
Amen.
That's great. Let's go on this mud tour in the volcano.
Let's do it, man. Let's do it.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. This has been great. Let's